Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. The Covenants of the Gods, Chapter 1, Holy Matrimony versus Marriage.
Holy Matrimony versus Marriage is one of the first pamphlets I ever wrote. It was written in a fit of passion after my father had left me with his law books when he retired from the law, and I had been reading those law books every day, mostly beginning with Black's Law Dictionary, then Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law and other books. I knew that Samuel Johnson had once said that words are but the signs of ideas, but I had no idea that those signs could mean so many different things. The location of a sign will tell you something different in one place than it does in another. Words can mean something different depending on where they're used, who is using them, and when they are being used. If you're using words in a legal setting, you should be using a legal dictionary to determine what they're talking about. The assumption that people are telling you what you think they're telling you because you have a definition in your mind as to the meaning of those words is a very dangerous assumption. Words don't always mean the same. When we're looking at the Bible, we see written in English, whether using the King James or other translations and versions of the Bible, they don't necessarily translate them perfectly. No translation is perfect. It is always advisable to go back to the original Greek text and look at what word was used there to find out what English definition you should apply to a given word. The word world, five different Greek words are translated into the single English word world. Which one was used in the context of where you're looking at it? There are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 definitions of the word world in the English dictionary. Which one is best suited to fit upon that word? Are we talking world planet? Are we talking Disney World? Are we talking the world in general as an inhabited place? Or the world that we know in a particular time or sequence? What are we talking? Wayne's World what? We need to know what that original Greek word is in order to understand in depth what the authors are really telling us. In Acts 7, verse 19, we see the same dealt subtly with our kindred and evil entreated our fathers so that they cast out their young children to the end that they might not live. Well, the word there for young children is actually brephos in the Greek, which really normally would mean fetus. And this idea of casting out our fetuses really had to do with abortion. Even the word that is translated might not live is actually better translated might not bring forth alive. Abortion was around in those days. It was around in the time of the Hippocratic Oath. It says in there, thou shalt give no pessary, which simply means an abortive substance. Why were these abortions taking place? Because they evil entreated our fathers, because they had laid great burdens on them, and they were no longer under Joseph in this bondage in Egypt, but that bondage had become more and more severe, and the economic burdens and drudgery of that bondage now was placing a tremendous economic burden on the people, and also seducing them away from concepts of morality that had been around for so many years before. There had been writings before the Bible. There had been knowledge before the Bible that we see written by Moses. Where did Moses find this information from? And the people were forgetting that. And other men were leading them astray, and they were preoccupied with just surviving in this bondage. The word same dealt subtly. That dealt subtly actually comes from a Greek word that is comprised of several different Greek words containing the Greek sophizo, which actually means to circumvent by artifice or fraud, conquer by subtle devices, to outwit, to devise cleverly or cunningly, to play the sophist. Sophist, it's characterized by Plato as a superficial manipulator of rhetoric and dialect. By changing the meaning of words in our minds, we change the meaning of the original author. And it's so important to realize that these words are symbols of ideas, and it's not enough to have an idea of what the Bible says today. It's important to know what the author meant. In order to do that, we must study to show ourselves approved and rightly divide the word of truth. And there are many men out there studying and seeking to know that truth, but there's lots of different opinions, lots of different ideas coming out of these seminaries. They've become somewhat uniform in the last 100 years or so, but the fact is that there is a great difference between what men, scholars, have as an opinion as to what the Bible actually says. Because it's a big book, and language is so much babble. Because every word can have so many different meanings. And which one are we going to put here? And if you do that with 5 different words in a sentence and 100 different words in a paragraph and 1,000 different words in a book, it's difficult to tell what is actually being said unless we start to look at the whole theme of the Bible and see what keeps popping up. And, of course, we need to pray and ask the Holy Spirit. Daniel Webster, who wrote one of the early dictionaries in American, has come down to us as the Webster's Dictionary, says, "All the miseries and evils which men suffer from vice, crime, ambition, injustice, oppression, slavery, and war proceed from their despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. If we abide by the principles taught in the Bible, our country will go on prospering. But if we neglect its instruction and authority, no man can tell how soon a catastrophe may overcome us and bury all our glory in profound obscurity. The ways of civilizations have always been to rise up to a peak of affluence and then decay down into a time of decay and destruction and debilitation. Is that what's happening in America? We see America setting aside the concepts of the Bible. We see them taking concepts like the Ten Commandments out of public buildings and out of schools, etc. And what do we see? We see the end result. This is not a new event. This has happened time and time again. Why is it happening? Do we really understand what the Bible says even when we pick it up? Are we victims of sophistry already? Have people changed the meaning of words so that we don't really understand what the original authors were telling us? Let's go back to the beginning of the Bible and find out, what is the Bible all about? It's about man. It's about man's relationship with God and man's relationship with institutions of man that often interfere with man's relationship with God. But it begins, we'll look at Genesis 1:27. "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. And the Lord God said, It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helpmeet for him. And that helpmeet is woman." But when you say helpmeet, it sounds a little subordinate there, but really they were both created in the image of God. They were both created for a particular purpose, and that purpose is God's. And he also created them so they needed one another. Even the word helpmeet there in the original Hebrew, it's 3 Hebrew letters, and those same Hebrew letters are also translated in another word as treasure. This is a necessary part of man. He needs that woman, not only to procreate and to be fruitful, but as a spiritual creature to test the mettle of that man. Without her, he would probably, the joke is, of course, is that God looked into Adam's refrigerator and realized that he needed a helpmeet. But man is improved by a proper and godly relationship with woman. That's why God created that woman for that purpose, and vice versa. They need one another in order to become all they can be in the eyes of God. And God blessed them, saying, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the sea and let the fowls multiply in the earth. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. This is a structure that God had planned from the beginning, man and woman. It is part of the design in this creation we call mankind. In Matthew 19, verse 3 through 6, we see the Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? There's that concept. From the beginning, male and female, for a purpose. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. This is what God intended from the beginning. Even Jesus tells us this. We see it in the Old Testament, we see it in the New Testament. This is not something new. This is not something odd or strange. It is part of God's plan. They say unto him, Why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? This is another controversial question. They're not giving up so easy. He say unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. Jesus made it clear, that is not God's plan. It happens. But it's not God's plan. And if it happens, it's probably because of the hardness of somebody's heart. They're unforgiving natures. And we will suffer for these events. And many people have suffered for these events. We've created our own hell on earth sometimes from these events. But if we understand how God wants that to be a permanent relationship, before we enter into that relationship, we will take it very seriously. We will contemplate that commitment. But what is that commitment? This organization we call family, husband, wife, and the fruitful children that are multiplied from them. This is ordained by God that this should be. It's a binding of two as one flesh. No more twain in the eyes of God. In the eyes of God, they're one. They're not separable. Fundamental. It's foundational. It's from the beginning of even creation. It's the foundation of all society and all government is actually found in family. And we'll see some of that. When the foundation fails, all fails. This is the key to the success of any society. When the family is breaking down, as we saw in Rome, as we see in other cultures, when the family breaks down, the whole society begins to break down and becomes corrupt. If you want to dominate and oppress a people, first, you oppress the women. That's a concept that has come down to us through the age. If people doubt that, they better study their history a little bit more. You have to break down the marriage, that matrimonial bonds, to separate the children, separate husband and wife so that bond is not permanent. And then you will be able to control the people. If you can't, the treasure of that relationship will be destroyed. Holy matrimony is the basic union and structure laid down by God for the dominion of man and woman and their families upon this earth. And how does it come about? It comes about through a covenant, a natural covenant between man and woman and God. The Bible talks to us about covenant from the beginning to the end. Hundreds and hundreds of times they talk about it. They call it leagues. They call it covenants, it's contracts, it's agreements with parties involved. What you give as your yes is yes and your no is no. And oaths are even worse. And Jesus tells us that. But Exodus tells us, Thou shalt make no covenants with them, nor with their gods. Over and over again, that is repeated throughout the text. Well, if we talk about contracts and covenants, we're talking about things that to do with the law. And of course, law is a broad range of subjects. There's all kinds of law. But basically, there's the fundamental laws that God has set down from the beginning, which we see defined in things like the Ten Commandments. And they're pretty basic. They're almost common sense. It doesn't require a degree in knowledge or law in order to know that to kill somebody is not a good thing. It should be obvious to murder, to steal what is not yours. Although some people have a problem with seeing that there's something wrong with that. And it seems a shame that we have to actually write it down. But the fact is that it has been written down. The Ten Commandments and those same concepts over and over again, the fundamentals of it, have been written down throughout the ages. And, of course, the Ten Commandments was not a religious document. It was a document that was the fundamental law for an entire nation of people, the same as the 12 tablets of Rome or fundamental law that covered the legal system that was amongst the people as they created it over the first 500 years of the Roman government. It wasn't an empire, really, until the first emperor was Augustus, which was 500 years after its beginning, or even more. So, let's look at the law and see some basic concepts in what the law is all about. Common law is the law of the land in America. And there's also statutory law. That's another kind of law that is also operates side by side with the common law, but it is also subject to law. You can't just make any kind of statute. There are limitations both by constitution and by basic laws of morality and the maxims of law that have come down to us throughout the ages. There are other systems of law like equity as well. But here in Blacks, we'll look at one little statement that kind of covers a broad range of the concepts of law that we'll be dealing with here to deal with marriage and matrimony. An analysis of the science of law presents a view, first, of the rights of persons, distinguishing them from natural persons and artificial persons. Well, even the word persons at all should always raise red flags in your mind. But also, body politics or corporations. These rights are deemed either absolute, as relating to the enjoyment of personal security, liberty, and private property, or, on the other hand, relative. So, absolute rights have to do with inalienable rights granted to us by God. And there's another group of rights that are relative rights that have to do with our status, with agreements that we have made, with events that we have done that have created a relative relationship and therefore a relative concept of rights. And that it arises out of this relationship in which several persons stand. So in order to have this relationship, it always requires another individual or another person in order to create a relationship. It's not a soulful, singular thing. Yet those inalienable rights are yours if you're the last man on earth. These relationships are either first public or political. So they divide that. There's public on one side or political on the other. The relationship of magistrate and people, or second, as private, as the relationship of master and servant, husband and wife, parent and child, guardian and ward, to which might be added relationships arising out of private contract, such as partnerships, principal and agent, and the like. Now, this is from Bouvier's. This is a very old dictionary, legal dictionary. It was used at the time of the Constitution. It's still used now because you have to use a dictionary used at the time the Constitution was written in order to figure out what the Constitution is saying. Can't use a modern Webster's dictionary to determine what the Constitution is all about because the words have changed their meaning, but it is the intent of the original document that is important. This is why, in order to understand the Bible, we must look back in history. You can't just use a Webster's dictionary and a King James Bible and figure out what it says, because since the King James Bible was written, the language has changed. Even to use a more modern text Bible, you still may not understand because this idea of translating, things can get lost in translation. And so, therefore, you need to study to find out exactly what it is that the author meant not necessarily what the translator meant or what Webster's means today. But the interesting point here in this thing that I read about the law and this analysis of the science of law is that they say that first there is public or political, the relationship of magistrate and people, or second are private, as the relationship of master and servant, husband and wife, parent and child. They categorize husband and wife as a private relationship. Even contract is a private relationship. And of course we know in the Constitution, the right to contract shall not be infringed. We often see that now you have to become a licensed contractor. Well, to demand a license to do something that you have an inalienable right to do would be unlawful, and the statutes have no authority to require a license to contract unless that contractual relationship falls under some sort of status condition that the statutes do have authority on. And you may be required to get a license to contract in certain circumstances. But basically, as a free man in the world, you have no need to get, if you're truly free, you have no need to get permission to contract unless you're contracting with somebody else who you wouldn't have a right to contract with without permission. So we talk about that in a lot of other studies. Basically, I just wanted to show you that husband and wife and parent and child, even guardian and ward, are considered at the time of Bouvier's to be private relationships, not relationships over on the side of magistrate and people, public and political. It's over on the side of private. Now, that's not necessarily what you have today with marriages, and we'll take a look at why that is. But at one time, that was the case with marriages. They were a private relationship, and there was no way in which the courts could interfere with that contractual relationship of marriage. That came in much later as things evolved, although it's not a new idea. It's a very old idea, and we'll look at that also. Law, as distinguished from equity, denotes the doctrine and procedures of the common law of England and America, from which equity is a departure. We deal a great deal in equity in America today. It's an administrative system of law. And it is a departure from what we call the law. Although many of the things that we see in equitable relationships or equitable situations, for instance, when I first read Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law, it talked about rights of the husband, rights of the wife, rights to custody of the children. And this was all under this one chapter called Husband and Wife. And then there was another chapter called Marriage, and it said rights of the husband, rights of the wife, rights of the custody of children, but it had a different remedy. One was the remedy was at law, and the other one, the remedy was in equity. And when equity began to raise its, maybe we could say ugly head, but that would be a judgment statement, but whatever it was, when it began to become a greater influence in the law, there were so many contracts that were at law before that, they needed to write at the bottom of a contract that the remedies for this contract were in equity. Because otherwise, everybody would assume that the remedies for this contract were at law. And a different set of procedures would follow. But later on, as time went on, equity began to have greater and greater influence. And by merely the way in which the contract was written, we would know that the remedies are at equity. In the Judiciary Act of 1789, which we can't get into all in this study session, but and it has to do with the law, and we do that in Law versus Legal a little bit more in depth. But basically, the common law is the law of the land, but where there is no remedy at common law, the remedy is found in equity. Well, if you create a contract where there would be no remedy at common law, then you automatically, that contract or agreement or application is going to fall under equity. It's a whole different system of law. It's a departure from law. So a lot of times when we say you have to obey the law, you're actually saying we have to obey the equitable agreement or contract that we have created. It may be law now, but it's only law by contract. And we'll see that the union of man and woman is of the law of nature. That's a maximum law that stems way back into the Roman times and still found in modern law books. The union of man and woman is of the law of nature. But that's not the only union that we will see. Just because you say you're married, that's not necessarily the union of man and woman. The laws of nature are most perfect and immutable, but the conditions of human law is an unending succession, and there is nothing in it which can continue perpetually. Human laws are born, live, and die. Again, another maxim come down to us throughout the ages. Husband and wife are considered one person in law. Again, another maxim. According to the law and the common law, all things which are the wife's belong to the husband. And they twain are one flesh, so then they are no more twain but one flesh. This union of husband and wife is in the old Roman law, a manus, so the wife comes and is joined with the husband. Everything that was hers is now both of theirs. They're one individual. That concept is biblical. Romans used it. It's in the law over and over again. It is not always what we see in the relationships today, because the relationships today have been a departure from the law. We call it law still, but it's really equity. Bigelow says equity winks at the law, because it looks a lot like that, but it isn't the law. It may be law because they have bound you in a contract, but you have agreed to that. You have made that law. You have gone under that authority. Submitting yourselves one to another in fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. A lot of people want to use this first part of the quotation to make their wives submissive and oppressed in the family. We're partners in this. We're equal partners in this. Yes, there is someone who has one position of authority and another one who has another position, which is also of authority, because you can't separate them. They may separate themselves, but really you want to get them together. Well, how did Christ love the church? By sacrifice, by service. And I find that women don't mind obeying husbands who truly cherish their wives, who make their decisions in the best interest of their wives, and have truly loved them as Christ loved the church. The problem comes when they don't. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies? He that loveth his wife loveth himself, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherishes it, even as the Lord the church. Well, that's true, but yes, there is wickedness where people do hate themselves, and they hate everything around them, and they are not at peace. But we're talking about Christian people who really love God and therefore do love themselves, because they know they are a creation of God. And they must love their wives, and their wives must love their husbands. Let the husbands render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. This is a reciprocating relationship. These are one thing. I mean, you cannot kill the right side of the body without killing the left. And so this is an important concept, and it comes back to us again in Mark 10. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. These are all important concepts to understand in marriage. Now, we're going to take this a little bit farther, and we're going to look a little bit at the history of law concerning marriage and matrimony. And why the history? Well, we've been doing that. We look back at Genesis. We look back at the time of Christ and the apostles and men like Paul. So, now, what do we know about this whole concept in relationship? We've talked a little bit about this equity thing and common law thing. Is this something new that came out of England, or is this as old as the hills themselves? Now, a number of these maxims of law that stem way back into ancient times are just repeating these precepts that we see in the Bible, in Genesis and at the time of Christ. And yes, many times we see things mentioned in the Bible, and we know, like divorce and these things that seem like they are separations from the principles of God. And of course, Jesus tells them it wasn't that way from the beginning. And of course, we're not just trying to get back to the Old Testament. We're trying to get back to the way God wants us to be. But these maxims include the ideas of the union of man and woman is of the law of nature. And in our study on law, we see that the law of nature is really defined as divine will. The laws of nature are unchangeable, another maxim of law. But one is very interesting. Matrimony ought to be free. Now, how does that relate to the Bible? Well, it's very clear that for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. That means that he is outside of the authority and control of his father. He still must honor his father, but it's at his discretion and choice. And if he were to die, his wife and children would fall back on the burden of his father caring for him. And so that's why there was this honorarium that was passed up to the father, because the father would care for those children if something happened to him. It was part of the social structure. Nowadays, the state stands in the position of father, and often we contribute to it, and it's supposed to take care of us. But originally, that was the state, is the patriarchal system of fathers and grandfathers were the state and the government. All government is based on the family. And it's simply the state taking over the role of the father that has allowed it to become this gigantic family. There was other systems by which to do this that were not top-down authority. They were grassroots systems that were bound together by faith, hope, and love. And of course, that's what Moses tried to create. That's what Jesus Christ preached. But basically, we want to understand that matrimony ought to be free. There should be no strings. The in-laws can't come over and start dictating to this husband and wife as to what they could do and they could not do. There was a certain responsibility that they needed to work out between each other, but there was no authority. Matrimony ought to be free. Now, matrimony is defined as marriage in the sense of the relationship or status, not the ceremony itself. We're using that word matrimony as distinguished from marriage for a good reason, but marriage is not necessarily something distinct. It has usually more to do with the way in which this matrimony came about. Status, the legal position of the individual in or with regard to the rest of community. The rights, duties, and capacities and incapacities which determine a person to a given class constitute his status. So we just had two different definitions of status, one as an individual in regards to the rest of community. So he's separate from the community, an individual. But the person, when we use that term, the rights, duties, and capacities and incapacities which determine a person to a given class constitute his status. So these are two basic concepts of status. Statuses are different depending on whether you're a person or an individual, what contracts and capacities that you have gone under, you know, the situation of your life. So that's an important concept to remember, and we'll return to that. But right now, let's look at Rome. Rome had this concept of matrimony. They called it matrimonium, which is, of course, where we get the word matrimony. They had several different forms of matrimonium. Ferarum, coemptio, and usus. Those are Latin terms. Ferarum actually has to do with the word grain. And so if you were married conferatio, that meant you were married with grain. And of course, today, we actually see at weddings people are throwing rice. Okay, that's where that came from. That's with grain is the concept. But the legal or lawful position of that relationship was very interesting in Rome. That was the way in which was most prized to be married. And the families wanted to be married according to that conferatio. This was called matrimonium juris gentium. And the concept there included the idea, gentium really has to do with family. It became known as nation in the law of nation, jus gentium. But matrimonium juris gentium had to do with the law of the family, juris meaning law. And it was the family in which this whole relationship took place. The woman moved her manus, all her rights and possessions that was let go by her father with her, moved over into this new family. And basically, if it was free, which of course the Romans were prized themselves on their free matrimony, all those things went into the husband and wife's family. And people actually brought bags of grain, not just throw a little rice, and they enriched the family so that they would begin their life in the proper independent fashion. Later on, there became a different kind of matrimonium due to the statutory requirements that began to pop up, and this was called legitimum matrimonium. It was a much different type of relationship than the one that was under the family. This other relationship we see, usus, was simply living together for a year. And there was no manus of the wife united with the other. And it actually came into popularity with servants who came into Rome to work. Coimcio was kind of a fictional sale or contract where the manus of the bride was entailed over to the husband. And often there were lots of agreements and stipulations. But the pure form of matrimonium was this conferatio, which was a free matrimony. When you went over, you were now completely free in this other unit. Both the husband and wife were free. So that was a concept. Actually, that's a biblical concept. Why does Rome have it? Rome knew all about Israel. They were great historians. They knew how that government was established. When they threw out the Tarquinian kings, they created a government very similar to those ancient patriarchal system created by Moses. Not a lot of the rituals and robes were changed, but many of the principles and precepts were there. There were some Roman variations, and those variations grew, especially as they came in contact with the Greeks. But it was a very similar system, and it prevailed for almost 400 or 500 years in Rome. It became corrupt also, just as it had become corrupt in Israel. All government without consent of the governed is the very definition of slavery. What is mine cannot be taken away without consent. A contract is law between the parties having received their consent. Now, these are maxims of law. Actually, that first was Jonathan Swift who said that. But basically, governments obtain a great deal of their power and position and authority by our consent. We have to agree to it. I mean, somebody can't just come in and say, we're the government, now everybody has to do this, that, and the other thing, and start making all kinds of statutes. They gain power because we consent to give them that power. God gave us that power. They have no rights. Governments have no inalienable rights. They obtain rights when the people waive their rights. That's how government works. If you waive a lot of rights, then the government has a lot of power. If you waive very few rights, the government has very little power. They don't have power because they write up a constitution and agree they like it. We have to agree we like it too. And that's the way it works. That's the way it always works. Now, you can have pirate-type governments who come in with force of arms and conquer the people and, you know, put a gun to their head and say, you have to do this, and, well, maybe you have to do that, or he'll shoot you. But that's just, you're just seized by pirates. They don't have any authority to say that. And as soon as you get a drop on them, you can take that gun away from them and say, now you do this, because you're a thief. You're stealing my rights. You're usurping authorities I have not yet consented to. And, of course, that's what David did with Goliath. Goliath said he was the authority, and David said, oh, no, you're not. God is the authority, and hit him in the head with a rock, because he kept saying that he was the authority and trying to rule over Israel, and that was not permitted. So governments gain power because we give it to them. So this concept of contracts, of course, immediately comes into this relationship of matrimony. And it does so by way of this marriage, which is this ceremony or act. And that can vary greatly and end up with much different results. So let's look at Bouvier's. That's that older dictionary at the time of the Constitution, what they say about marriage. And they say it's a contract made in due form of law, not talking equity here, by which a free man and a free woman reciprocally engage to live with each other during their joint lives in the union which ought to exist between husband and wife. By the terms free man and free woman in this definition are meant not only that they are free and not slaves, but also that they are clear of all bars to a lawful marriage. Now that's what they're telling us. Now what would be one of the bars to a lawful marriage? Well, Daddy didn't say that she could get married. She's still under the authority of her father. She can't go get married until he gives his permission. So that's one of the bars. The definition goes on to say, to make a valid marriage, the parties must be willing to contract able to contract and have actually contracted. And of course, there are terms of contract, which we go into elsewhere, but basically there has to be an agreement, a meeting of minds, there has to be an exchange, and they have to come there, you know, part of that agreement honestly, and of course they have to have capacity. All these things are mentioned there. Willing to contract, in other words, you understand the agreement, able to contract, that there are no bars, and that you have actually done this and made the exchange. You know, if you don't say I do, it didn't happen. Even the word wedding that we have, that actually comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, wed, which means a covenant, an agreement. And so marriage has always had this concept of agreement. You have to agree. There's a, even with Isaac, there was exchange and an agreement before they ever even met. It was someone else was carrying this out, but eventually they weren't really married until they moved in together, and then the contract was completed. So, in Black Third, we see a contract is talked about a little bit differently. A contract according to the form prescribed by law, still law, by which a man and a woman capable of entering into such a contract mutually engage with each other to live their whole lives together in the state of union which ought to exist between husband and wife. So that's almost identical, a little bit different. It's Black's Third. That's an older dictionary. I think they're up to Black's Eighth or Ninth now. And the definition has been altered somewhat in those books, or at least it's beginning to slide more in a different direction. But one of the most common maxims of law that you'll see, like at the United Nations or in United Nations documents, is pacta sunt servanda. Pacta sunt servanda. Agreements must be kept. Well, of course, non pacta, non servanda, if there is no agreement, it doesn't have to be kept. So you have to make this contract, and basically what we're talking about here is a contract between two people. Now, is it holy matrimony, where it's a contract between two people before God, or is it just living together like usus, where they just make a contract between themselves? Is the contract, who is the authority over the contract? Where is the remedies? Is it at law, or is it in equity? Well, of course, that's a big question. That makes a big difference into what that thing we call status is. Remember status? There was the status of the individual in regards to the rest of the community, but also status are rights, duties, capacities, and incapacities which determine a person to a given class, which constitute a status. So your status may mean that you're not in a matrimony that is free, depending on how you conducted that ceremony of marriage. That which bars those that have contracted will bar their successors also. So this is going to even have an effect on their children. And so we're going to look at a couple of definitions that come along a little bit later and are actually talking about something that's quite different than what we talked about up here, as this perpetual joint lives as husband and wife that ought to be free, that is done by two free people. We're going to talk about another relationship, looks very much the same, uses many of the same words, but is quite different in its status. So we've seen marriage as simply a contract between a free man and a free woman, husband and wife. They consent, they contract, they're able to make the contract, and they actually make the exchange or the agreement or consummate the act. Now, there are many ways in ancient history to do this. The old marriage under the canopy, formal gatherings and get-togethers where they exchange vows in the public and everybody knows what's happening and what's going on. And then they go home and they consummate the marriage. They set up housekeeping, all open and above board and all completely married. No one else needed. Now, there is this word marriage used by another group of people. Same word, marriage, spelled exactly the same way, but they're talking about a different condition, a different definition. And we'll find that definition in the same dictionary, but it is a much different type of relationship. And we want to know, is this second relationship in accordance with God and what God wants for man and woman in this very sacred relationship that we call husband and wife? Marriage, as distinguished from the agreement to marry and from the act of becoming married, is a civil status, of one man and one woman united in law for the discharge to each other and to the community of duties legally incumbent on those whose association is founded on the distinction of sex. Now, when I first read that many, many, many years ago, I thought that sounded pretty good, but then I began to find out what words mean. They're distinguishing this marriage from the agreement to marry and from actually becoming married. The other definition included those things. But specifically, they're telling us that this marriage is a civil status. That's very important. It's a civil status. It's not a free status. There are strings attached. We call those strings duties legally incumbent. So it's not a free marriage, a free matrimony. There are obligations, and it is all done under an authority, and provides with it, at the end of the event, a different status than that private contract of marriage. So marriage is a personal relationship arising out of a civil contract to which the consent of the parties capable of making it is necessary. Consent alone will not constitute the marriage. It must be solemnized. It must be followed by a solemnization of that consent or by a mutual assumption of marital rights, duties, or obligations. Now, that's from the California Civil Codes. And they're saying, of course, that it is a civil contract. It's not just a private contract. It's a civil contract. So as soon as you read that, you know you're already been removed from that private side of law, and now you're in the public side of law, and you're under the authority of the magistrate, the civil magistrate. He is now the authority of this contract. He has power over it. He is the god of this contract. He will exercise authority over this. You have literally written down there at the bottom by applying and obtaining this license that that's okay with you. You have consented to that. And you have solemnized that with this application and marriage ceremony. You go and get a licensed minister who has permission from the state to perform these civil contracts. That's not holy matrimony. That's not an ecclesiastical matrimony. And we'll see that in a minute. Marriage is a union of one man and one woman, so long as they both shall live, to the exclusion of all others, by an obligation which during that time the parties cannot of their own volition and act dissolve, but which can only be dissolved by the authority of the state. They are not joined together by God. They are joined together by the state. And the state has taken on the position of God. And the more you hear from us, the more you will realize exactly what that means. But we'll look at Ohio's references to marriage. So that was California. The last one was Washington. And now we're over in Ohio. And we could go through all the states. But these are just a few that I put together for today. Ohio marriage law documents. This is actually copyrighted out of the Ohio State Bar Association. Marriage is a legal as well as a spiritual and personal relationship. When you repeat your marriage vows, you enter into a legal contract. Remember, the word legal comes from the Latin lex legere, which means to bind. It's not the same as law. Things become law because you bind yourself by contract, and that's how you make the law. You're not under this contract until you consent to it. You're not under those duties and obligations until you go under those by consenting and contracting under them. You don't have to do that in order to become married. You choose to do that maybe from ignorance, maybe because you want some special benefit that you think you'll get from that. There are three parties to that legal contract: you, your spouse, and the state of Ohio. Now, I can't get much clearer than that. They're telling you this is a three-party contract between you, your wife, or your spouse, and the state of Ohio. The state is a party to the contract because under its laws, you have certain obligations and responsibilities to each other, to any children you may have, and to Ohio. What you do when you make that contract, that's how you get those duties. If you don't make the contract, there are no duties. Pacta servanda sunt. Non pacta, non servanda sunt. No agreement, No obligations. Agreements must be kept. If there is no agreement, then you have no obligation. You don't owe the state of Ohio anything, as long as you don't enter into a lot of other contracts with the state of Ohio. Remember, the law of nature is most perfect and immutable, which is the divine will. But the conditions of human law is unending succession, and there is nothing in it which can continue perpetually. Human laws are born, live, and die. And how are they born? They're born by your consent. You have to consent. That's why they want you to make these contracts. You're giving them power. 1906, the Supreme Court of Nebraska states, it, referring to marriage, differs from all other contracts in its far-reaching consequences to the body politic itself, and for that reason, in dealing with it or the status resulting therefrom, the state never stands indifferent, but is always a party whose interests must be taken into account. How does this all come about? Marriage license. A license is permission granted by public authority to persons who intend to intermarry. By statute, it is made an essential prerequisite to the lawful solemnization of marriage. But that has to do with that marriage that is a civil contract. And we know that there are other kinds of marriages that are not civil contracts. So, when we want to get marriage, should we go and get a marriage license to the state? We know that a license, from this point of view, or permission granted by public authority to a person who is intending to intermarry. That's what that is. But that is also entering into a contract. Now, let's look at Clark's Summary of U.S. American Law. That's a very fundamental book, and it's one of the first ones I began to read. All lawyers should have read this, but you'll find, as I found with some where the lawyer underlined when he had it in school, he never underlined anything under constitutional law, and he very seldom underlined anything under the common law, because that's not what lawyers today are dealing with, even though from the very beginning in America, common law was the law of the land. That was the one that had precedent over all other systems of law. Equity could only find remedies where it was no remedy at common law, especially if you made a contract or an application where the remedy was already decided to be at equity. You're no longer at the law. Remember, equity is a departure from the law. So I don't want you to break the law. I want you to go back to the law and stop going under this equity, which is a departure from the law, and waiving your God-given rights. But Clark's summary states, marriage is often referred to as a civil contract, but the emphasis in such a reference is not upon the word contract, but upon the word civil, as distinguished from ecclesiastical. Since there is religious freedom in this country, a religious ceremony and rules of ecclesiastical organizations with regard to marriage have no legal significance. Legal meaning binding significance as far as the civil aspect of the contract. Now, when you go to church and get married, that's not an ecclesiastical marriage. That's a civil contract. That's a civil agreement because your minister has often gone down to the local county seat and got permission to perform this marriage. That's not their business. They shouldn't be doing that. They should be separate from the state. They shouldn't be performing solemnizations for the state as a clerk of the state. They're supposed to be the clerk of God, clerk of the kingdom of heaven. They're supposed to be serving Christ. They're supposed to be entering people under the perfect law of liberty into holy matrimony, which is free because we know it ought to be free. And they should be binding those people not under the state, where the state now has exercising authority over their relationship, but they should be binding them as a witness, not with any particular authority, but as a witness under the authority of God, not under the authority of the church or the state. And the state agrees with this. This is Clark's summary. This is a fundamental law book. They're telling you this. This is not a secret. Nobody's revealing it to you, and your minister should be. And if you're a minister, you should learn this and start telling people, because this is a part of the gospel, and we'll show that after a bit here. Though mutual assent is necessary to enter into a marriage, the marriage itself is a status or relationship rather than a contract. The rights and obligations of the parties thereto being fixed by law instead of by the parties themselves. In other words, you agree to give the state the power to decide what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil in your relationship. This is not holy matrimony. This is a legal binding agreement between you, your spouse, and the state. You're going under an authority. Hence, marriages are not within the provision of the United States Constitution forbidding the states to impair the obligation to contract. So this is really important to understand that I'm not saying that you should break the law. I'm saying that you should abide by the law, and the law says that you can get married as a private contract. You may need a license, but you don't want to get that license from the state. Remember, license is permission. You want to get that license from your parents if you're still within your household. Because there, even Samson went and got permission from his father to get married. Daughters should get permission from their fathers and their mothers because they're a part of the family. They're a part of that union. As the husband and wife are one flesh, the children are within that household and under the coverture of that household. And so therefore, when they want to get married, they need to get that permission. And when they get that permission, that's their license. If they're going to the state, then they have put the state in the position or in the role of father. And of course, we know Jesus said, call no man on earth father, but my father in heaven. And he did so when it was very clear that the Roman emperors were called our father, patronus, and all the senators were called patri, father. And we find in that Greek text where it says, call no man on earth patri. Same word. And so all the people knew exactly what he meant. And as we talk more frequently, we'll see how this system works and plays out in relationship to the Bible. Until we meet again, peace on your house. And may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net. Welcome to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. The Covenants of the Gods, Chapter 1, Holy Matrimony versus Marriage.
Now, in our previous examination of holy matrimony and marriage, we see that holy matrimony was an institution of God from the beginning. It was a part of creation, a part of His original design. It was His institution, His creation. We see Jesus Christ also repeating some of the same basic concepts we see way back at the beginning in Genesis, that it's two people joined together, a man and a woman, and that they are joined together under the authority of God as if they were one person, and that joining should never be interfered with or put asunder by anyone except for God. We see it as a foundation of society. It is the precept upon which all government is established. It is the same precepts we see flowing through holy matrimony. We also see that it is a covenant between two people, and in order to make it holy, it also is before God. That principle is critical to understanding what holy matrimony is and how it ought to be free. It needs to be free, otherwise there is someone meddling into that relationship which is only before God. And even the Bible bears this out, that the son and daughters who marry are to leave their father and mother and forsake them. It doesn't mean abandon them. It means that they become a unit unto themselves. They still had ties in ancient times to their parents. They still honored their parents. If something happened to the husband or to the wife or to both parents, it was the parents of the son, usually, who took the children in and continued to guarantee that they would be raised and taken care of. This was a part of that social security. This is what a patriarchal society is all about. We see that the political societies that men create for themselves with these contracts has often taken the position or taken the place of the father in the ancient patriarchal societies such as Israel. We see that the word marriage has several definitions, some of them quite distinctively different. We see that marriage is a relationship between simply a free man and a free woman who have contracted together because they were able to contract, because they desired to contract into this thing we call matrimony. And that contract was called marriage. But we also see another kind of contract that is talked about by the civil state, where the contract is a civil status, where it is a civil contract, where it is solemnized by activities and participation with the civil state, and that it carries with it certain duties legally incumbent upon the two, along with the community, and that it is a three-party contract between a man and a woman and the state. Now, before that, all our definitions clearly did not designate that there was this third-party contract. But in this civil contract, which is called marriage, the same as that previous contract, which was not civil, which was private, as it was designated in the law, there is this vast distinction between what the duties and what the authority is in that relationship. That relationship of marriage under the civil state, or under a civil status, is a very controlling power over that husband and wife relationship. They can't dissolve it on their own. The dissolution of property is often determined by that civil power. The dissolution or placement of the children is often decided by that civil power. And it is clearly that when one enters into such a contractual agreement that they become unequally yoked with the powers that make statute. And also that this relationship is not required by law, but is actually a departure from the law. Because you are entering into a relationship where there is an equitable control over this relationship. It's now a public relationship. It's under the magistrate. It will be decided by statute and not by law. Now, some people would find that surprising. Is statute law? Well, yes, it's created by law, but the law is basically the law of contract. I mean, there are basic laws such as not being murdered and not being robbed. These are obvious basic laws, but you have rights, inalienable rights, that are granted to you by God. And if someone were to come and take away those rights, that would be a violation of law. But if you were to contract with somebody so that you no longer had access to those rights as you fulfilled the terms of the contract, then that would be a new law that you were a part of that creation of. And this, of course, is why we are told not to make these covenants wherever we go. Now, we've talked a little bit about holy matrimony. We've mentioned it. But there is a thing called the rite of holy matrimony, and that's R-I-T-E, rite, as opposed to R-I-G-H-T. But the rite of holy matrimony is really very simple. A rite is, it's a Latin word that means duly and formally, legally, properly, and technically. So when we talk about the rite of holy matrimony, we are just talking about what's proper in holy matrimony, the technicalities of holy matrimony, what is its formal necessary aspects in order to create that relationship. Well, they're really very basically simple. We've talked about several of them. Obviously, if holy matrimony would be matrimony under the authority of God, not under the authority of someone else, what would be proper is, of course, that it was a man and woman, because this is a matter of the law of nature and the divine will of God, and clearly he created man and woman. And he joined them together, and for the purposes of being fruitful and multiplying, in any other relationship such as man and man or woman and woman, does not follow that criteria and therefore would not be proper. This is obvious, basic common sense. Now, there's a lot of debate that the state is talking about legalizing homosexual marriages. And of course, the state can go and do that. Christians really shouldn't be having those state marriages because those are three-party civil contracts with the state, giving the state power over a holy relationship that is to be free before God. There is no reason for a Christian to do that. They are giving up inalienable rights granted to them by God when they do so. They are actually becoming unequally yoked, which they are not supposed to do so. So we see very clearly that that holy matrimony is not what we see taking place in the civil contracts with the state. There are a few other things that might be a part of that rite of holy matrimony. If you go to a church and get an ecclesiastical matrimony, which has no legal significance with that body that was producing this civil contract, and therefore it is not civil in nature, but free in nature because there is religious freedom in this country, are you getting married under the authority of the church? Well, no, you're not. That's not what the church's function is. The church is not allowed to exercise authority. This is a command of Christ. You are not to be like the governments of the Gentiles who exercise authority one over the other. So clearly we are not to be that way, even though we know that a legal marriage is going under the authority of the state with that matrimonial relationship. Now, just as an examination so that you can see another witness, I'm going to quote from a canon law. Now, canon law, that's a little frightening term for a lot of people because they associate it with some bad things in history. Canon law is not like a legal statute law. It's more like words and phrases. Canon law has no authority. Hopefully, those things that have been written down by men to be canon law are supposed to be those men's opinion of what is divine will. That's what canon law is supposed to be. It may be in many cases. Each one of these cases we should look at individually and pray to God and find out and discuss these things and study these things out and see, are they in accordance with the Word of God? Well, one canon law is the CCC 1623 to do with marriage, so I'll read that here. In the Latin Church, it is ordinarily understood that the spouses, as ministers of God's grace, mutually confer upon each other the sacrament of matrimony by expressing their consent before the church. Now, clearly, I have no problem with that. All they're saying is that the church is a witness to their consensual agreement. That's a very free interpretation of this relationship of sacramental or holy matrimony. And I would have to agree with what that particular canon law states. Because you're not married under the authority of the church. You are married under the authority of God, who is called as a witness to the contract that you make. He is the one who joins you together, not the church. The church is just facilitating the public announcement of this union, this contract, this covenant, this relationship that is before God. Remember that an ecclesiastical relationship is distinguished from that of civil and secular. It is a separate one. But you are just as married. Remember also that the word church is from the Greek ekklesia, which is two words meaning the called out. Now, there are many words that mean assembly in the Greek. Some of them show up in the New Testament. But they specifically use this word ekklesia in reference to what we now translate as church. And it means the called out. Well, like the Levites were called out, and so was the first century church called out to minister to the people of the kingdom of God, which was at hand. Is your church calling you out or calling you into a relationship with a foreign power, a civil authority, which you are not required to do, but when you do, you waive certain God-given rights? This is the question that we're bringing up. We know that matrimony ought to be free. We know that civil is a word used in contradistinction to military, ecclesiastical, natural, or foreign. And we know that marriage is a natural relationship. Husband and wife is a natural relationship. We know that all an ecclesiastical relationship is that the church as a body bears witness to your natural relationship of husband and wife before God, which is the way it was from the beginning. We know that marriage is a contract by which a free man and a free woman come together in this union of husband and wife, one of the greatest domestic relationships, that relationship being that of a man and a woman lawfully joined in marriage, by which, at common law, the legal existence of the wife is incorporated with that of her husband. These are traditions that come down to us through the ages. We also know that in the time of Plato, he had a number of different ideas that were contrary to what we have been talking about. For instance, his economic plan was that no gold or silver was to be owned by any citizen. It was to be kept in a treasury away from them. Because, as Hitler says, gold in the hands of the people is the enemy of the state. It gives them a certain sovereignty and freedom from government. Egypt and Israel, the Israelites, with their golden calf, they were trying to do the same thing, and Moses clearly disapproved of that. Socrates had a concept of the equality of between the sexes, that women would be in the military, wives and children held in common, and women will be permitted to have sex with almost anybody, but yet the husbands of those women were responsible for the raising of those children. These are all concepts that came out of Greece with Plato and Socrates. He had the idea that men would have no private women, no private children or servants, and also that the land and property that he held and worked was actually owned by the state and could be taken away from him if he did not produce enough income for the state to operate on. Now, these are all concepts completely contrary to what we see Moses doing, where the people had possession of the land. They could not be taxed on the land. They could not be taken off of the land. That the husband and wife were a sacred unit. That the children belonged to the parents, and the parents were supposed to train them up. And that they were to carry their gold and silver and be responsible for it in their own purse. Completely diametrically opposed to this idea that we see coming out of Greece. In 2 Kings 17:15, we see, "And they rejected his statutes and his covenants that he made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed vanity and became vain, and went after the heathen that were round about them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them." And of course we see Jesus Christ saying the same thing, that we were not to be like the kingdoms of the Gentiles, who had their benefactors, who exercised authority. And of course that's not the way America was originally, but it has become that way, where the government has control over every aspect of our lives. And the reason why is because we have done what God told us not to do, and that was to make covenants with them. We have become like the heathen round about us, who believe in concepts such as no differencing between the sex. Now, there is an equality. We're both created in the image of God, but the idea that there is no difference is simply ridiculous from the point of view of biblical understanding of creation. The idea of taking all our gold and silver and putting it in the treasuries of the government, and we simply having some sort of script in our pockets, is also clearly contrary to what God had in store for the people back in the time of the Israel and in Egypt, where we were told to have no diverse weights, etc. All these things are practices of the heathens. They are not part of the rights of God's kingdom. In other words, when I say rights there, that's that R-I-T-E right, because it's not proper. God is the same yesterday as he is today, and we should not be changing these things, and we are changing these things by our activities, by our contracts, by our applications. Now, Romans 13 tells us, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." Well, how are they ordained of God? They are ordained of God because God expects us to keep our contracts. Of course, he tells us hundreds of times not to make these contracts, but if we do, he will hold us to them. And they get their power from our application and contract. In 2 Corinthians, we see, "And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with infidels? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? For ye are the temple of the living God, as God hath said, I will dwell in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." But are we doing that? In 2 Corinthians it also says, just before that, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion hath light with darkness?" We are having a fellowship with systems that are doing contrary than what God has taught us from the very beginning. We are becoming unequally yoked by our contracts, by our applications, with people who do not believe in the Bible, do not believe in the precepts that God has given us through the ages of prophets that have gone before and through Christ's own words. "Wherefore, come out from amongst them, and be ye separate," we're told. "And touch not the unclean things, and I will receive you, and I will be a father unto you, and ye shall be a son and daughter, saith the Lord Almighty." Now that has long-range influence through the activities that we are participating in. Are we really sons and daughters of the Father in heaven, or have we become sons and daughters of our Father, the state on earth? I mean, we ask them for permission to marry, which used to be the exclusive right of our parents. We ask them to train our children. And in other meetings, we go into detail how this we are really turning the state into our fathers here on earth. We have gone under the authority of a state that is contrary to what God has ever created, that is more like Egypt, which God chose to take us out of, told us never to go back to. And how do we go under that? Well, of course, as I said over and over again through contract, Exodus 23:32, "Thou shalt make no covenants with them nor with their gods." Now, are we making covenants with gods? Well, actually, we are. It says, "They shall not dwell in thy lands, lest they make thee sin against me. And if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee." Now, people want to say those gods are just little statues, and we go over this over and over again, that clearly throughout history, that's not what it was. That's not what the words mean. If you look in the Greek text, the word God, theos, it was used every day to address magistrates in courts of law because they had an exercising authority. Even in Strong's Concordance, it will tell you that these gods are ruling judges. Even the Bible tells us that. If you take King James Bible, several places where the word Elohim in the Bible shows up, they translate it judge because it says they brought them before the judges. But that's the exact same word that's translated everywhere else into the word God. And even again, in the Strong's Concordance, will bear you out that that was a term used to address magistrates, public magistrates. So see, by that contract, that covenant, you are making covenants with gods. You are going under exercising authorities that have a right to rule over what should have been a holy matrimony and is now a civil contract, a civil status whereby you have gone under the authority of another, something Paul said he would not do. He would not go under the authority of others. Now, I know a lot of these concepts are new to you. If you get a lot of our other material, we'll show you over and over again in books like The Covenants of the Gods and series of tapes that go along with that, exactly how this works. And it's repeated over and over and again in the Bible. This is not just made up by somebody. It's clearly laid out in the Bible. We show you there's over 600 footnotes in The Covenants of the Gods and other books that we have available that show you where we're getting this from. We wouldn't want you to take our word for it. We don't want you to believe in us. We want you to look at the Bible. We want you to pray about it. We want you to believe in the precepts of God and the precepts that have come down to us through the Bible, as Daniel Webster says, that we need to know those and live by those because it will make a difference, not only for our everlasting soul, but for the lives of our family and our children here on the face of the earth that God has given us. We are told, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of the sacrifice. Now the fact is, if these gods are judges, men who have exercising authority, that's why Rome, Caesar was called a god. And we think, oh, how blasphemous. All it meant was that he was the apotheos of Rome, apotheos of Rome. He appointed all the judges. That's what that office did. Of course, the President of the United States has the same office. He appoints all the federal judges throughout the entire empire of the United States. No, we don't want to call empire the United States, but the fact is all the states are separate countries bound together by contracts and agreements with this single authority, which has become stronger and stronger because it too has contracted with the federal government. And that federal government literally stands in the position of appointing gods throughout the empire. The federal judges are very active. They have a great deal of power. It wasn't that way at the beginning, but it has come that way over the years. Even the President of the United States is referred to as the apotheos, apotheos, just like it was in the time of Rome, as well as the word imperator meaning commander-in-chief. These are all commonly understood precepts. Capitol Dome, the picture in the head of the Capitol Dome, if you look up there, there's a big, huge picture with George Washington in the center and all the Greek gods around there, and it's called the apotheos or apotheos of Washington. That's the name of the painting. And on the U.S. government website, it tells us that it raises Washington to the rank of God. That's actually what it says, quote unquote, because he is the ruling judge in the sense that he could pick all the other ruling judges. We have a Supreme Court here. They had a Supreme Court in Rome as well. There's the United States and Rome are identical forms of government. The emperors were actually elected by an electoral college. It often became totalitarian, and there is no reason to believe that the United States might not do that as well. But that is their problem. We're Christians. We're to be seeking the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness. And if we do that, everything else will work out. So how does this relationship, this contractual relationship, this unequal relationship with the state affect us in our relationship with our families and our children? Well, we know in Genesis 35:11 that it says, "And God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee. The king shall come out of thy loins." Well, what kings? Well, all the people in Israel were called kings. The head of every household was a king. It says for 400 years there was no king in Israel, and every man did as he wanted because his tent was his castle, his home was his castle. And we talk about that in great detail, how that worked, how they still had an orderly government without a top-down authority, and how all that changed when they turned their back on God and decided to have a top-down authority government that was chosen by the voice of the people. It was a representative form of government, but still there was authority placed in the hands of these people in the higher echelons. That's not the way Israel was at first. The Levites had no authority. They couldn't compel tithings. Things like that didn't take place till about 160 BC and 78 BC when they passed statutes to force the collecting of the temple tax. That's when tithings and free will contributions became tax, contrary to the wish of God. Genesis 33:5 says, "And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children, and said, Who are those with thee? And he said, The children which God hath graciously given thy servant." In other words, God gives us our children. We are one flesh, and our children are the product of that. Those children belong to us. Now, the state may have a different opinion of that, but we know that that's what God wants, and that's what we should be working for, and we should do nothing to endanger that right to our children. We should do nothing that betrays that trust that God has placed in us by entrusting us with those precious lives that are the children and the fruit of our wives' wombs and the fruit of our loins. Custom and the common law also agree with natural law. For at the common law, the father had an almost absolute right to the custody of his children. And of course, the father and wife are one flesh. But there was no custody of the children by virtue of the state. The state didn't own the children. Now, Socrates had that idea. Socrates advised in Plato's Republic, take all the children from their parents and rid the city of adults. These are these wise men that they have been teaching our children about in the universities and in the colleges. That was their idea of what is proper and right. He also says the young can't distinguish what is allegorical from what isn't, and the opinions they absorb at that age are hard to erase and apt to become unalterable. But of course, we see similar things said in the Bible, but of course, they're teaching different principles. They're teaching the sanctity of the home and the importance of marriage. Now, we look around at the rate of divorce and the breaking up of homes. Something is going on here that is an abomination. Let's turn and look at some other opinions of modern government and see, are they in connection with the Bible? Are they in agreement? Or are they in agreement with these heathens, such as Socrates and Plato, who are smart men and clever men, but not wise according to the ways of God? In 1983 in Nebraska, there was a conflict between a small Baptist church and the state of Nebraska. The conflict was over the fact that the Baptist church wanted to have its children taught in its own little private school, and the state wanted them to be highly regulated in this activity. They thought that the state was usurping rights that were given to them by God, and they would have been correct except for the fact that they had actually waived those rights already. There was a kind of a touching scene, as it was described to me, between the judge and that pastor in jail, where the judge informed the pastor in a roundabout sort of way so that he could understand what was really going on, and he was completely missing it, is the fact that the church had already incorporated under the state. By becoming an incorporation of the state, you waive your rights as the body of Christ, and you are now become a part of the body of the state. And you are now highly regulated by the state, and controlled by the state, and by the state statutes, and by the judges of the state. Because they are now the ones who have exercising authority over you, because you have sought after the heathens and their gods, their judges. And so now they have authority. Now, you can call them wicked if you want. Jesus already told you to make anything more than yes for yes and no for no. Any other agreement, swearing, binding agreement, contract, cometh of evil. He's already told you that. You knew that. You just didn't apply it in your life. So you went out and incorporated your church. Now, we go into great detail and explain all about that in Body of Christ versus Body of the State. And that's, we have it in pamphlet form. We have it in other forms. It's also the last chapter of the Covenants of the Gods. But the point is that it is these previously existing contracts that got them into trouble. The state was not usurping authority. It had already been given away. And it had been given away because they had applied to the state so that they get benefits of the state. And that pastor learned that he wasn't going to do that anymore. But an interesting quote came out of this whole thing from a Peter Hoagland, who was a Nebraska state senator at the time. In an interview with the pastor, he made a statement that was, fundamental Bible-believing people do not have the right to indoctrinate their children in their religious beliefs because we, the state, are preparing them for the year 2000, when America will be a part of a one-world global society and their children will not fit in. Now, that idea and many ideas that are similar to that are pervasive throughout government and the world today. It's interesting that they refer to the right to indoctrinate their children in their religious beliefs, but when the state teaches the children their beliefs, it's not indoctrination, it's just education. Actually, we do have a right and an obligation given to us by God to educate our children. And it's stated over and over again, and it's just common sense to realize that. And to educate our children does not mean to have somebody else educate the children. You don't actually hire the teachers. You don't control the curriculum. Even if you got terribly involved in your local public school, you would realize that it is a bureaucracy out of your control, and you have very little say-so. You can kind of fight at windmills or buck at the ocean out into a little hole, but you're not really going to have much effect on it. Even if you gather together in a fairly large group, there's a certain amount of authority you're just not going to obtain. The children should be educated at home. And in congregations of people, they can facilitate that and do an excellent job. Homeschoolers right now score 30% higher on all tests, and as well as social skills, they're much higher rated in social skills, better adjusted even in colleges and universities. And you can actually go all the way through college in the homeschooling courses now and save a tremendous amount of money. You will probably have to go away, depending on what studies you're taking, to do lab works and things like that. But a great deal of it can be done at home at a tremendous cost saving and very successful. Because if you've already learned how to study and learn, those homeschooling courses can make you quite capable, more so than those who's, you know, people tell me that the university is a fountain of knowledge, yes, and all those students go there to drink, but not so much the knowledge. There's a great deal of influence in the colleges that is not exactly to the benefit of your children. Anyway, there's these ideas, where do they come from? Well, clearly that, like William Sewell said, each child belongs to the state. It does if you've contracted away your right to your children. Some of these ideas come from men like Socrates and Plato that I was always told are really brilliant, smart, and intelligent men. But the more I got into what they were writing and telling and began to grow up, I realized that they were very intelligent men, but they were not very wise men. And they certainly were not teaching precepts in accordance with Jesus Christ or the Bible. And they're actually preaching a form of governance that is absolutely contrary to the principles that were handed down to us in the Bible. And most people don't even know what those principles were because they've been highly distorted and not really attended to in the way that they should be, in my humble opinion. But we have a great deal of information on this, and you can access it on the web or wherever and find out if we're telling the truth. Socrates advised in Plato's Republic, which is not really a republic. Plato's Republic is kind of like Wayne's World. It's Wayne's World of the Republics, because it was really contrary to everything that was a republic. But they call it Plato's Republic. I didn't realize that until much later when I went into much deeper studies of what these things are. And we cover that in Republic versus Democracy and Democracy versus Republic. Take all the children from their parents and rid the city of adults. That was Socrates' idea. He thought that was a great idea. Well, that's that. The communists did that. When they took over Phnom Penh, they got rid of all the adults and the children took over. The young can't distinguish what is allegorical from what isn't. And the opinions they absorb at that age are hard to erase and apt to become unalterable. Well, that's very understandable. We see in Proverbs, train up your children in the ways he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. They're just using the ideas out of Proverbs. The problem is what are they teaching them when they've removed the adults? Are they teaching them wisdom? Are they teaching them God's principles? Are they teaching them heathen principles? Carol Warner said those who educate are more to be honored than those who bear the children. The latter give them only life. The former teach them the art of living. Well, that's very true. And I can't disagree with that. My question is what do they call the art of living? Is the art of living according to those precepts that are in the Bible, or are they according to promiscuity, irresponsibility that I see? Are they learning how to use drugs and other paraphernalia that are destroying their lives? Are they developing values that will be breaking down the family? Well, all of the above. Those things are around. They're rampant. And we're putting our children out on the front lines of this corruption and expecting them to come out of the schools uncorrupted. If the teachers and the books don't twist and distort their minds, their peers will. Some children survive in spite, but homeschoolers are scoring much higher, both in social skills as well as academics. And not only that, the parents are rewarded in the process of homeschooling in ways they cannot even imagine. And we are told in the Bible over and over again, "And ye shall teach them your children, speak of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up." That's homeschooling. That's what it's all about. The kids are there all the time. "Gather me the people together, and they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children." These principles are repeated over and over again in the Bible, and I see nowhere where Christ changed that. "Suffer unto me the little children." Not send them away to somebody else who won't even let a Bible in their school. People said, "Oh, it's terrible that they're taking the Bible out of school." To me, it's terrible that you're not taking your children out of school. You should be homeschooling. That's my opinion, and you can take it for what it's worth. Now, I should talk to you a little bit about the word person. We mentioned it before that it's a very important concept to understand. In one of the definitions in Black's Third, it says marriage is also defined as that which signifies the act, ceremony, or formal proceeding by which persons take each other for husband and wife. Well, persons are members as opposed to individuals. They're not the same thing. Persons are members of something, and their status depends on the nature of that membership and what they're a member of. In American law and procedure states the word person and its scope and bearing in the law, involving as it does legal fictions on one hand and apparently natural beings, it is difficult to understand, but is absolutely necessary to grasp at whatever cost a true and proper understanding of the word in all its phases and proper use. Well, we're not going to do that here, but we do touch on the word person over and over again in the Covenants of the God series and in other places where we're even not delving so deep into subjects of law and the Bible and history. But that concept of person, some people talk about straw men these days, that's a real popular term. Basically, a person is a member, and a person is measured according to his status. The mere definition goes on to say the law of persons is the law of status or condition. So if you're a person, your status or condition is what is determined in that identification as person. A moment of reflection enables one to see that a man and a person cannot be synonymous, for there cannot be an artificial man, though there are artificial persons. Thus, the conclusion is easily reached that the law itself often creates an entity or a being which is called a person. The law cannot create an artificial man, but it can and frequently does invest him with artificial attributes. This is his personality. That is to say, a man person, the abstract person, which are fictions and which have no existence except in law. And that is to say, those which are purely legal conceptions and creations. Now, this word fiction keeps showing up now and then. A lot of people think, well, that's a fiction. That doesn't have anything to do with anything. When Christ says they are no more twain but one flesh, referring to a husband and a wife, they aren't one flesh. That's a fiction. But in the point of view of Christ and the point of view of God, they are one flesh. He treats them as if they're one flesh, even though they're physically not one flesh. They're not Siamese twins. They're not sewed together. It's a purely legal conception or creation. But, of course, when God says it, it carries a great deal more weight with me than, say, some bureaucrat says it. But the fact is that what the governments of the world do is take the principles of God and they turn them to their own purpose. This is what Cain did with the first city-state. This is what Nimrod did. Pharaoh, Caesar, this is what these centralized governments who take the position of father are doing. They're taking the precepts laid down by God, and they're creating in their own image another system. You still have someone who teaches the children the art of living, but their art of living is based on different concepts other than that of God, as it was from the beginning. And the whole point of studying the Bible and trying to find out what God's will is so that we can turn around and follow that will in our lives in a practical way, not just a few hours on Sunday where we sing about it, and not with just kind of pie-in-the-sky concepts of God's way, but God's way that affects every aspect of our lives. I mean, Christ is telling us many things to do and not do. He says, swear not at all. How many Christians swear on a regular basis? Swearing is not cussing. It's taking oaths. It's making agreements. And the idea that Jesus is saying not to do that because it cometh of evil is not a new idea. James says, above all else, stop the taking of oaths. Why? Because over and over again in the Old Testament, God was telling us not to make covenants, not to make contracts with the people or the inhabitants or with their gods. These are agreements. What agreement have we with Belial? We're not supposed to be making these agreements. And if you make those agreements, you change the nature of your personality. You change the nature of your person. Now, you may be a person already because you have a membership. But turning around will start taking you back in the other direction. When Moses came to Egypt, he didn't say, okay, everybody, rescind your documents, get rid of your pharaonic ID, and stop paying taxes, and let's go do our own thing. No, he went through a whole process, and there was hard times, difficult times, and the people learned to work together and fill their water flasks and glean in the fields at night, and they did a little overtime, and they congregated together so that in one day, in one moment, they woke up, or actually maybe they never went to sleep that night. I'm sure some of them dozed off. But anyway, they got up the next morning and they walked out. They had a whole system that was ready to go. And they were interconnected and able to go out into the wilderness. Now, of course, the early Christians on Pentecost, they didn't have that. They didn't go necessarily to a wilderness, although many of them did wander away from Israel before its destruction. Many of them were there right up to the last day of its destruction of Jerusalem. The point is, they started creating that network. That network was already under construction when Jesus Christ was preaching the kingdom of heaven and had supporters everywhere and was sending out his apostles to preach the kingdom of heaven. And there was actually groups of men who were doing something very similar to John the Baptist. And before John the Baptist, were already preaching the kingdom of heaven. Even Herod was preaching the kingdom of heaven, but his idea of the kingdom of heaven was an art of living that was more in line with the Hellenists, with the Socrates and the Plato crowd, with the idea of separating and breaking down the family and getting all the gold and silver in his treasury and where it might be stolen. And of course, the kingdom of heaven doesn't operate that way. The money stays in your pocket, the way Moses said, the way Jesus says. And you must decide daily how to grant that money and share that money with the other members of your congregation in times of need. And you create a network in which to do this. And family is at that core. Every person is a man, but not every man a person. A man is a term of nature, a person of the civil law. Wife and son are names of nature. The civil law is what people establish for itself. God's law is much different. Unless those people are very godly people. But what we see being established today and for many, many years as the civil law is contrary to what we see established in the Bible. And the reason it has power and authority is because you're contracting and applying to it and giving it that power and authority. Governments don't have power unless you give it to them. You must go under their authority and give them that power. You need to learn how to live in the world, but not of the world. A person who is in present possession of an office, one who is legally authorized to discharge the duties of an office. If you get a marriage license, husband and wife are no longer the natural terms that we see mentioned in those maxims that I just read to you. It is an office. It is an office delegated to you by the authority of the state. You are now a person. Your personality is tied in with the state. Your soul, literally your soul, is tied in with the state. A soul is, from a legal standpoint, is your corporeal or incorporeal hereditaments of personality. And that's what it consists of. When Abraham left the city-state of Ur, he took many souls with him. In other words, they gained possession of themselves and they went out and did something completely different. There's a sample bill that was created in order to comply with U.S. Code Title 42, Section 666. Just happens to be that number, folks. I didn't say anything about the Mark of the Beast, but this is actually its number, Section 666. We wrote about this years ago in the Ecclesia News when it was first, before it even became laws, any of this. But we knew all about it. We're telling people. There was Bill 532. It was back in 1997. I'll give you a lot more details on it. But basically, the document requiring a Social Security number for use in child support enforcement. And they do this for other purposes. But it says no marriage license may be issued unless a written application shall have been filed with the probate judge. Goes on, Darlington County and Georgetown. This is a sample bill. Counties, the clerk or the court who issues the license at least 24 hours before its issuance. The application must be signed by both of the contracting parties and shall contain the same information as required by the issuing of the license, including the Social Security number of the contracting parties. That's very important. It's exactly the way it was in the time of Rome, when the early Christians were fighting the same basic system that was rising up. What some of you might not have understood, that U.S. codes are divided up into a lot of different numbers, titles, they call them, and this is Title 42, and the Section 666. They needed bills in each individual state to comply with this mandate that Social Security numbers will be tied to every aspect of your life. Businesses, even you can't even get a death certificate without a Social Security number. And of course, we have a lot of information on what the Social Security number is. I'm not telling you to go get rid of it. I just want to tell you what it is. You and God have to work out whether you should have one or not. And as Paul says, if you can be free, choose it rather. But if you can't be free, you're going to have to labor under that system until you can get free. And if you owe the taxes, pay the taxes. It's because you have to learn to be friends with the unrighteous mammon, for when it fails, and it will fail, that you will be more suitable for God's kingdom. And the righteous habitations, a more permanent habitation. And that concept is that basically simply give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Nothing is contradictory in the Bible. If you think it's contradicting itself, you probably don't understand what's going on. There is also, I just thought I'd mention one little thing about the reciprocating relationship of this idea of honoring your father and your mother. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. What does it mean to honor thy father and the mother? Now, we see that phrase repeated both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Christ clearly says that we should obey the commandments, including that one. We hear that one over and over again, even in the epistles. The words that were used to be translated into this word honor in the Old Testament actually means to be heavy, to be weighty. So are we supposed to be heavy with our father and our mother? Actually, what they're talking about is to increase, to fatten. Fatten your father and your mother. This honorarium that was given to father and mother, it's not about going to bed when they tell you, although you should do that too. It's about honoring your father and mother even after you depart from their house. When you get married and you separate and you should honor back to your father and your mother. Eventually, theoretically, whatever you give to your father, you will inherit. But that was a system of governance that was operating from the beginning, even before Israel. And it was just repeated again in Israel, and it was also repeated in the first century church. We still see remnants of that. But what's happened now is we've gone under the system of Corban, and Jesus says, you know, woe unto you, cried Corban, who make the law to no effect. What law is he talking about? Honor thy father and thy mother, because Corban was simply you give a stipends to the temple instead of honoring your father and your mother. And if they needed help, if they need fall on Social Security kind of need for benefits, they simply get them from the temple, which was a part of the government, just like we see today with Social Security. That's a system of Corban. And this honor thy father and thy mother was that money that went to them. You have to remember, income tax, a lot of people say income tax is not statutory. And of course, it isn't statutory. Income tax is a patrimonial right. It's the right of the Father. The emperors imposed income tax. Herod began to impose an income tax. Jesus never did because he was returning to the ways of the kingdom. But it doesn't. There is a kind of income tax in the kingdom of heaven, but it's this honor thy father and thy mother. It isn't anybody kicking your door down. You have to make that choice. Remember, that choice is what makes a man a man. The exercise of charitable choice. That's the perfect law of liberty. It's maturing. The kingdom of heaven is only for virtuous people. It's for people who want to share, and people who are charitable, and people who are loving, people who are industrious, people who are not slothful. The kingdom of heaven doesn't work for people who are slothful. So in the New Testament, we also see this, the timios is one of the forms of the word to honor thy father and thy mother. And again, it's actually translated value as well as honor, but it means to estimate, to fix a value. So when they're saying fix a value on your father and your mother, no, they're talking about you decide what you're going to give your father and your mother according to the charity that is written upon your heart by your love of God. So this was the honorarium that was given to father and mother in the kingdom of heaven, and that's where all the taxes went. And of course, the tithes that went to the minister to support the minister actually came from the elder father, and he had the money to do that because it had come up to him by way of his sons and in his own earnings. And that was shared with the elder rabbi who had his sons ministering to all these families. And that's the way it worked. And it doesn't, you know, there's some flexibility in that, but that's a precept of how the system works. So that question, are men the property of the state or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today. A question brought up by Cecil B. DeMille in the Ten Commandments. Is that answerable by us today? Are we free souls under God, or are we free souls under the gods that we have created for ourselves, that we have called on for ourselves, that we have created by contract, by contracting into body politics to obtain benefits? Remember, Peter says, through covetousness they will make merchandise of you. You've desired their benefits. Like Proverbs says, you know, if you be a man of appetite, put a knife to your throat. You know, if you sit and eat with a ruler, put a knife to your throat, for they'd serve you deceitful meats. And David says, your table is a snare for you. This concept is repeated over and over again. By desiring those benefits and sometimes being cunningly coerced into waiving your rights due to ignorance, as the Supreme Court says, we have contracted into these systems and given up rights that God has given us and created obligations which brought us back into the bondage of Egypt. We need to repent and start turning around. This is a process. We need not to waste time in doing that, but we don't need to run out and get ourselves into trouble. We don't want anybody breaking the law. You need to understand what you're doing. You need to come together in congregations. You need to study these things out. Remember, I love this definition of redemption. Redemption is the deliverance from the power of an alien dominion and the enjoyment of the resulting freedom. It involves the idea of restoration to one who possesses a more fundamental right or interest. The best example of redemption in the Old Testament was the deliverance of the children of Israel from the bondage, from the dominion of the alien power in Egypt. Well, the best example of redemption in the New Testament, of course, is Jesus Christ, when his apostles came out and preached, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And with that, we found that they too were free, often persecuted, but free. And so now is the time of our redemption. Christ has arranged it for us. We need to only seek it out. Seek the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, and all else shall be granted unto you. Until we meet again, peace on your house, and may God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.